Okay, so to continue our exploration of this difficult topic. As I mentioned briefly, we can begin to take this journey, the understanding the emptiness of self, understanding what the Buddha was getting at with this selflessness, in a number of different ways. Certainly in the meditation practice, both through practices of cultivation, cultivating loving kindness and compassion and calmness, both through practice of cultivation and through practices of insight. Let's talk about that. Also by looking at our life, and I'll go into that. But as I said, we also move along this journey, begin to move along this journey very much in terms of our behavior, our actions in the world. It's not, of course, it's not irrelevant. So one of the qualities that very much, as I said this morning, very much loosens the sense of self and creates a fertile soil that we can begin to see deeply into its nature, is the quality of generosity, or dana. I'm familiar with this word, D-A-N-A. It really means the giving is what it means. The practice of giving, the generosity, and I also would include service. Moving the heart out in its expression of care in the world further than this little tiny circumscribed area, or those few people around me that have come to be important to me. Of course, that's an important part of life. But the aspiration to move it in a very wide way, to practice generosity, to practice service and giving. And it really is a practice. So it's not, something like you should be generous. It's more like a lifelong willingness and commitment to explore what generosity means in one's life. What are the edges of that? What are the limits? What are the no-entry zones on that? What is the power of generosity? What's the effect of generosity on oneself, on others, on relationships? To really take it up as a lifelong practice. Enormously rich, enormously powerful. And what one notices, and I think probably we all have a sense of this, that when we practice generosity, when we give, when the heart opens in that movement of dana, of giving, there's a lightness of being and an openness of heart and mind that come in as a organic kind of byproduct of being generous. We open, we let go to give, and that letting go creates a lightness, creates an openness of heart. We've had a little bit of taste of that, as I said, in our life, probably everyone has. But the Buddha says, don't underestimate that. Don't underestimate that. He said something like, if you knew what I know about the power of generosity, you wouldn't let one single meal go by without giving something to someone. It was quite a strong statement. And Buddhas, one of their characteristics is that they see extremely deeply and clearly what the repercussions and the effects of our actions are. So someone seeing very, very clearly what it is that really has an effect. And he's saying generosity. Really pay attention to generosity as something that opens the heart and moves in a very real way on this journey into understanding selflessness, into letting go of this prison, this constriction of self. So if we take generosity up as a practice in our life, we have that willingness, that openness to do that. It's very interesting. It's extremely interesting. We begin to see, perhaps one of the things we begin to see is, what are the areas in my life that I'm okay being generous with, And what are the areas that are... So one quite common dichotomy is, say, between time and resources, usually money. And just to see what one, where one is on this, there's no judgment, it's just kind of knowing oneself a little bit. I know for myself, when I have money, I'm quite happy to give it. But time is a little bit more, well, hold on. It's a bit more precious to me. And that's just, my brother is completely the other way around. So it's just personality type. But actually to know oneself and have a sense of, okay, then this is the area where I need to kind of push my boundaries a little bit, where I just want to test the waters of my edges a little bit. But for me, it's around time. Giving of my time to others. Some instances. We can give time, we can give money, we can of course give attention, which is a beautiful gift. You know, and how much loneliness and sorrow and pain in this world are actually the result of people not feeling seen, not feeling heard, not feeling attended to in a very deep and real way. So that when we give that to another, we are actually giving something very precious. And it's, I think it was Rilke, the poet, who said, to give attention is to love. I'm sure he said it much more beautifully and poetically. And in German. when we give attention, we give love. It's how we express our love. We can also give kindness. And what's that? That's a wonderful gift to give. And the Buddha said, when we develop kindness in the heart and we exude that and we give that, we are giving the gift of fearlessness to other beings. They know, they have a sense, whether it's human beings or animal beings, begin to have a sense. There's something in the vibration or something in the actions that they've seen. They know they can trust around us. They know they don't have to be on their guard. Tremendous gift to give that fearlessness to others. So to explore generosity in all its kind of aspects and the angles on it, there's a huge range of the ways we can be generous and stretch what that means in our life, explore what that means, question what that means, feel what that means. And to me, when I'm practicing this and engaged in practicing this, to me there's a real paradox here, or a seeming paradox. When there's generosity, and I see this in myself and I see this in others, when there's generosity, when one is giving away, letting go and giving, there's a feeling comes right there of having enough. One feels like there's enough in life. I have enough. It's a paradox. I'm giving it away and yet I feel I have enough. And conversely, if I'm mostly or only interested in saving, and I'm a bit stingy, basically, with the giving, I want to just make sure it's going to be okay for me, which is very human and very understandable. Just saving, not too much generosity. Maybe I'll have X amount in the bank or whatever it is, but I think there's always going to be some kind of gnawing anxiety. Maybe, what if? Maybe it won't be enough. What if... Da, 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 da. The very non-generosity feeds that gnawing anxiety. And the generosity feeds the sense of having enough. It's a real paradox here. It's, like we were talking earlier in the question answer period, Dharma is upside down. Upside down. All the deep teachings of Dharma turn the values of the world on their heads. And there's something very radical about just a kind of very basic teaching of generosity, which is what the Buddha put at the base of his teaching, generosity, right at the fundamental level. And already it turns the values that we have, that we live by, on their heads. There's this fantastic passage from the Buddha. I'm not sure where it's from. It might be from Mahayana, Mahayana scripture. He says, very striking. He says, what we give away is ours. What we keep at home is not ours. What we give away is of value. What we keep at home is of no value. What we give away, we don't need to protect. What we keep at home, we need to protect. What we give away causes no worry. What we keep at home causes worry. What we give away gives inexhaustible wealth. Inexhaustible wealth. What we keep at home will be exhausted. What we keep at home leads to negativity. What we give away leads directly to enlightenment. It's an odd thing. It's very radical, but it's also like, what exactly is he getting at? A strange statement. So one half is perhaps a little easier, that what we keep at home we kind of need to guard. We need to protect it. We need to make sure it's okay. We need to watch out for it. What we give away gives inexhaustible wealth. What does it mean? But to me, I think one of the things he's getting at is this teaching of karma, which we can scrap all that business about past life and reincarnation and you know, in another life I was Cleopatra or all that stuff. It's in this life I can see something if I pay attention. If I'm really honest and the heart is open, I'm paying attention. I can see that through generosity, through giving, I am nourishing and supporting an openness of heart and a letting go and the freedom that that brings, and that is an inexhaustible wealth because nothing, no one can take it away. It's qualities of heart that one is feeding through one's actions and one's orientation, and they stay with you. They stay with you. It's like a real treasure in the heart. What is what we tend to hold on to and look to for security, that's the fragile stuff. That's not the best investment. The Buddha's turning everything on its head. And it is curious, to me, I think is a really high level of maturity in the practice that actually really sees that, really understands it, and really lives by it. It's so tempting to put our sense of security in the material and building up and saving. But to actually see the power of generosity in one's heart, its power to bring a sense of freedom, sense of connection, sense of love, sense of happiness, to see that, to understand it to the depth that we're living by it, that's very, very mature practice. I mentioned, of course, we have a responsibility to those near us, to our family and the circle of friends. Of course we do, that's life. But in a way, the movement of the Dharma, we could say, the spiritual kind of directionality of this, is to begin expanding the circle of care, of generosity, so that it's not small and contracted around me. It's actually very wide, and the aspiration is that it's boundless. It has no limits, which is quite a tall order. But we can very easily begin practicing in this way. It's not so far-fetched as it might sound. But when I used to live in America, you probably have it here, it was involved in quite a number of different environmental organizations. They had projects where they sort of, for a certain amount of money, you can buy a patch of rainforest somewhere in some country, and know that it will be protected from logging and exploitation. So do they have that? I used to love doing that. There was something about it. I realized that I knew that I would never see this strip of rainforest. I would never enjoy it. I would never be there. I would never marvel at its beauty. In some instances, my ignorance of geography wasn't exactly sure even where the country was. But there was something about it that It was a giving an investment in something that the self would never see or enjoy. And in that movement, there was a kind of, it felt as if this sense of self began to expand, just began to grow and be much more embracing. Very beautiful. So the problem with the sense of self, one of the problems with the sense of self, is that it's often quite tight and constricted. And we don't have a lot of say when it feels tight and when it feels a bit more open. If we move, if we practice generosity, we're actually practicing this kind of loosening of the sense of self. Loosening and widening and opening the sense of self. So similarly, two or three years ago, I led a work retreat in the highlands of Scotland, and we were working on reforesting the Caledonian forest. Scotland used to be one huge forest, basically. Now it's very beautiful, but it's completely environmentally degraded. And so we were up there in the Scottish rain, basically. 7 days in it. planting trees and working on other reforestation aspects. And talking to the people organizing, it's called Trees for Life, this project, and talking to the people organizing it. And they said, this one guy said, it will take us 300 years to know if what we're doing is working. 300 years. How can self get wrapped around that? It can't. And no one was putting a plaque on any little sapling, Rob planted this, you know, this is mine, or anything like that. There was something in it, in the fact that I will be long dead. I won't know how it turned out. Something in it that's just beyond the limited scope of self. So the heart is moving outwards, expanding. The movement of generosity unbinds, that's the Buddha's word, unbinds the sense of self. It's moving towards unbinding the sense of self. And with generosity, it also means service, the movement of service, of giving in all kinds of ways, as I said. And it's interesting, too, if we really do take this on as a practice, sometimes we look inside and we see that there's generosity or service, but the motivation's a little bit questionable. And this is very human, it's very human. Sometimes we're giving because there's fear there. We're afraid of appearing stingy or appearing unkind, or we want others to think good of us, or sometimes there's a sense of unworthiness. We somehow feel like our very existence is not worthy unless we're earning it by giving, by the movement of generosity, seeking praise or approval, whatever it is. Extremely common. Sometimes a person begins to see that and then says, right, throw the whole thing out. And that's an understandable reaction. I don't know whether we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's possible that motivations in practice purify. They purify over time with consciousness, with steadiness, with questioning. Just in the process, one keeps the service up, one keeps being generous, but begins looking into the motive. So I sometimes tell people, you know, this business about motivation is purifying. You know, we can hear about the motivation that we're just practicing for the sake of all beings, which is a very beautiful, beautiful intention. Actually, one's doing this practice, the difficulty of it, for the sake of the welfare of all beings. But it's not that realistic when we start. And I remember going back more than 20 years, and I started, and I was in college, and I saw this poster, and it said something like, come and meditate or learn meditation at these classes. Calmness, stillness, power of mind, or something like that. I thought, great. Right, I'll go along to these classes and I'll get some of this power of mind business and then I'll be able to study quicker. I was at university. I'll be able to study quicker, which would leave more time for drinking. at the time seemed to be the main sort of purpose of the university life. But and of course, over the years, there's a purification that goes on. It just goes on naturally, a little bit. But the point is, it's okay if the motivations for giving, for generosity and service are not quite 100% clean. You feel that. Just keep practicing and just keep looking, questioning. So the movement is not from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. Usually other-centeredness is wrapped up in this kind of wanting approval or wanting others to see us in a certain light or to owe us something or not feeling worthy. It's more like self-centeredness to a kind of openness to a consciousness of interconnection, interbeing. Okay, so in a way that's just to pick out one or two strands from like how we live, generosity and service. What about another angle? How we're actually looking at our life. How we're looking at our life. Off the cushion, so off outside of meditation. How are we actually looking at our experience? So one practice that I've found very useful over the time is sit in your home, your house, apartment, whatever it is, and just sit on the sofa. It's not a big meditation, no lotus or anything like that. Just sit on the sofa and look at the living room and what you have in the living room. Look at your so-called possession. If you just keep the attention there in a kind of relaxed but sustained way, what you might notice is that after a time, the sense of them being mine just begins to die down a little bit. And so one can do this with one's apartment, one's house, one's furniture, stereo, all that, the property. You can even do it with your hand. If you just, probably not a good idea, like on the tube or something, but you just sit and look at the hand and keep the awareness there in a gentle way for long enough. After a time, there's a sense of, it's not really mine. One can also, if one's feeling quite adventurous, do this with one's spouse, or partner, or child, or parent, or lover, whatever it is. And just see something. And there's a shift, or can be a shift after a certain point, just seeing them as not mine. In that not mine, and it's just a temporary shift, and of course it comes back, just a temporary shift, but begin to sense a kind of freedom in it. Huh, relief, all this stuff is not actually mine. And there's a sense of just unburdening, potentially. Or a sense of preciousness, of freshness, of newness that can come into seeing those that are near to us, that we love. So the freedom of not fully believing in I have or mine, of not fully believing it. It doesn't bring in, or it shouldn't, let me put it this way, it shouldn't bring in a sense of disconnection, alienation, weirdness, coldness, aloofness, lack of love. It shouldn't be doing that. What actually happens, again, it's quite paradoxical. When there's this non-ownership of something, it actually allows love in. Very curious. You might wonder why is that. It actually allows love in. So, looking at one's so-called property or ownership in that way. Another area in our life that the sense of self kind of constricts around is around our roles. This is very very important, especially, well, it's important for everyone, I was going to say, especially for lay people, but it happens with monks and nuns as well. We get into a certain role in life, our job or this or that that we're doing, and somehow the sense of self wraps itself around that. And there's not much breathing space. And then someone shows up and says, sorry, end of role. You know, we're going to let you go, or whatever they say. or a partnership dissolves, or whatever it is. Some role ends, and because the self has wrapped itself around it, it's a problem. Or in the role, in the job, there's a sense of constriction. Something comes in, and the suffering comes in there because of our identification with roles. And we don't see they're just a kind of conventional reality. There's nothing inherently real about our role. So right now, I'm teacher, that's the role, you student, me speak, you listen. Me Tarzan, you just... that's just the role. There's nothing inherently real about it. The same with our job, same with everything. It's just a conventional agreement of society. And yet we can have so much suffering around this. A little while ago I was teaching somewhere else, and there was a man who had been a lighting engineer in the theater for about 20 years. And he's probably in his 50s, is my guess. 20 or 30 years he'd been working this. And he had to stop because he had to actually care for someone. And he felt very unhappy in the years since he stopped because he wasn't a lighting engineer. And everything that he felt he got from that was no longer. And so we just had a bit of a dialogue, and I asked him, well, how old were you when you started being a light engineer? And he said, 20-something. And I said, well, so you weren't a light engineer before that, but was it okay? Well, yeah. when you were a light engineer and you are sleeping, are you still a light engineer then? Or when you're on the toilet, are you still a light engineer then? So we take this concept and we kind of whitewash the whole of our life with it, and we say, that's who I am, and we get a certain amount of self-worth or self-definition out of it. We don't see all the holes in it. We don't see that it's just a convention that we stretch and then, put this stamp on. So the property, the role. Another way that this whole self-sense becomes very painful is the kind of views we have of ourselves. So it's normal human practice, so to speak, to define ourselves in a certain way. I am like this, I am like that, whatever. To see situations in terms of self, so to see what happens in a situation in terms of self or other. This happens because I did it a certain way, or as if everything's up to me. So I'll explain what I mean. Dharma practice, the teachings, are about seeing what comes out, what manifests in a certain situation, seeing it in terms of all the conditions that are coming together to feed that moment. So right now, this talk, it seems very clear. I'm up here giving a talk, okay, and hopefully you're listening. it seems like what's coming out of the mouth, the texture of the talk, the feeling in the room, that's all kind of dependent on the speaker. But it's interesting to do this over and over, and one really gets the sense that how the talk is, what's said, how it's said, feeling in the room, the whole thing of it is a complete, what the Buddha would call, dependent arising. It's some of you in any kind of performing arts, if you do any of that, you'll know this, or hopefully you'll know this. What happens in this moment depends on everything in this room. So that's the quality of everyone's attention, how sleepy I'm not, how interested, blah, 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 all that. What we all had for lunch and whether we're a bit groggy, all of it is coming into this. So what comes out of this mouth is a dependent arising. If I view every Dharma talk that I give in terms of depending on me, it would be a nightmare. It would be an absolute nightmare. Imagine the stress of it. I have to sort of come up with the goods all the time. This situation, I don't know, sometimes it's less obvious when you're actually listening, but sometimes it is obvious. It's a completely codependent arising. But the programming, the very deep habit of programming of human consciousness is to see in terms of self. I did a good job, I didn't do a good job. I said the stupid thing, I said a great thing. I, or you. So if we're not seeing in terms of myself, we're seeing in terms of someone else's self. And it's very, we really need to train ourselves to see this situation in terms of the web of conditions that are feeding it. Now, it might sound intellectually like, I get that. We need to do this over and over until the habit of seeing in terms of self just doesn't have that kind of strength anymore. So years ago, when I lived in America, I worked with a psychotherapist for a while, and she had some kind of black belt in sort of confrontational psychotherapy or something. No, exactly what it was. It was actually really good for me at the time. I was quite young, and it was very good for me. Some aspects were good, put it that way. After a while, something became clear to me. It took me a while to become clear. I would go in there, and because she was quite aggressive with her challenging, I would often be quite fearful. And then because of the fear, there was a kind of stuckness that came into the interaction, a stuckness in terms of my inner process and the dialogue with her, etc. And then the conclusion would be, you're stuck in your life. You're fearful. You're like this, or I would say the wrong thing, or not say this, blah, blah, blah. And it became quite a, some aspects of it was a very painful situation. Not seeing that her aggression was a factor very much feeding the situation. Maybe from the outside it sounds completely obvious, but we get into these kind of situations in interactions with others or in our work or whatever it is, and we're not seeing the conditions that feed it. Similarly, again, with the definition of who I am, we're not seeing how the mind is in a certain moment. It's also dependent on a whole web of inner and outer conditions. A whole web. So right now, what we had for lunch, what you did or didn't have for lunch, is actually affecting the mind state right now. What happened this morning, what happened yesterday, all of it, the input from the talk, all of it. So the mind state is, again, affected by many, many things from the present and from the past, from the present and from the past. And yet, what do? Oftentimes, we take one thing out, either inner or outer, and we say, that's the cause of my mind state, or that's even more troublesome, that's how I am. If we have a difficult mind state that seems to appear like depression or anger, we say, I'm depressed, I'm a depressed person, I'm an angry person, I'm this or I'm that. We define ourselves based on something that's coming and going, not there all the time, nothing can be there all the time, and what's more, it's coming and going dependent on conditions, inner and outer, and yet we see it in terms of self and self-definition. Anytime we do that, suffering is not very far away. It's either right there in the moment, or if we've wrapped ourselves around something positive, I'm, you know, wonderful and brilliant and radiant and all that, just a matter of time before we meet someone who doesn't agree with us. And they'll say what they think. We'll think, to the self in definition, wrapping itself around any definition, suffering comes. To use the Buddha's analogy, as sure as the wheels of the cart follow the ox that pulls it. Not a very 21st century analogy, but... So there's how we act in the life, the generosity, the service. There's the cultivation practices, loving kindness, calmness, compassion, etc. There's how we look at our everyday life. How are we looking? Are we looking in terms of self? And then there is the what we call insight practice, the using the meditation itself to begin looking at the self in a different way. So after some point in practice, not really point, after some time of practice, put it that way, a certain time spent looking in, one may ask oneself, where is this self? Where is myself? Where is it? And begin with a sort of steadiness and over time of looking at the flow of inner experience. So that's what this practice, if you knew, that's what this practice is heading towards, actually moving towards encompassing everything in the inner and outer experience. One brings mindfulness to it all. So it doesn't just stay with the breath. Everything. Body, breath, feelings, emotions, mind states, sensations, thoughts, all of it. And when I look inside in a sustained and interested way, in a careful way, with sensitivity, what I see is I can't find anything that doesn't change. I cannot find anything that does not change. Not the body, not the feelings, not the emotions, not the thoughts, not the sensations, nothing. And I say, where is this self? The sense I have of self is of something fixed and lasting and independent. I feel myself to be, we feel ourselves to be the same person we were 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 2 years ago, 2 months ago, 2 days ago. But when I look inside, I can't find anything that stays. I really can't find it. If I really look for it, I can't find it. This can be very striking. If one actually goes looking for the self in one's meditation, you realize you cannot find it. And one spends one's life, which is limited. We have, our life is limited in time from birth to death, however many years that is. It's limited. We have limited life. One spends one's life and one's energy, which again is limited. We only have a limited resource of energy as human beings. I spend my life and energy basically at the whim of this self. When I look for it, I can't find it. It can be very jarring, even. Can be. Shakes things up. That's a better way of putting it. Also, to talk more about the meditation practice, the way that the Buddha favored, and it's also the way that I like to teach it more often, the way that the Buddha favored working with this in practice is, as I said this morning, not so much to make statements about there is a self or there isn't a self, or I shouldn't have a self if I'm a Buddhist or you know, whatever. It's rather to see the present moment experience and see that I don't need to see it as self. So sensations happening, we were talking about this in the question and answer period earlier, sensations are happening right now in the backside, wherever, in the feet. Typical, without even realizing it most of the time, we see it as my sensations. Very normal, very understandable. And of course they're mine and not yours. Buddha says, practice seeing if you can see them as not self, not me, not mine. They're just happening. It's just happening. So right now, sensations in the feet or in the backside, the way they're just happening. Not me, not mine. And this is a practice that we practice looking at the experience of the present moment as not self, as not me, not mine. Okay? So we're not making any big metaphysical statements, any philosophical this or that. So practice in the moment, can I regard this moment's experience as not self? It's a practice. It's a practice, Buddha said, it's a way of looking. One practices a way of looking that leads to freedom. So, body sensations, feelings, thoughts, emotions, mind states, the whole shebang of what we can observe, can we regard it as not self? This is really a practice. So in the looking, usually for most of us, it's a practice that one takes on once there's some degree of calmness. then begin looking in this way. And say I'm aware of body sensations or an emotion. Actually, to see if I can very lightly view it as not me, not mine, not self. So for some people, it's a very quiet label. It's just happening. It's not me, not mine, not self. As a way of unhooking the identification that we usually have, whether we're aware of it or not, with the object of our experience. So it's really a practice that one gets skilled at, and as the practice deepens, one can get skilled at this practice. And we understand we don't need to see anything as self, anything at all that we conventionally take as self, including awareness. So that's a whole other level of this practice. Some teachings say you are awareness. That's your ultimate nature. You are the witness with a capital W and a capital A. And it's tempting to feel that, because if one has let go of identification with the body and the emotions and the thoughts, very nice freedom. What's left is the awareness. One can say, this is my true nature. So when one is able, I'm talking about very deep levels of practice now, but just so to create a map for you a little bit. When one is able to let go of identifying with the object of experience, body, sensations, feelings, thoughts, emotions, all that, then one has to unhook the identification with awareness. It's a very, very deep level of practice. And it's much more subtle and in a way more difficult to do, but possible. So we practice seeing all this as not self, breath, body sensations, thoughts, all of that. I just want to give a gentle shove. So, it's really practice. It's an avenue of practice. So, again, for some of you relatively new to practice, one may feel, well, I just need to be in the present moment with mindfulness. Maybe that's enough, but maybe not. At a certain level, other kind of options open up. I'm just painting a picture for you of in the future feature presentations, I don't know. We can see, though, the identification with this stuff, with body, when it's when we're identified with the appearance of body or the feeling of the body, illness, discomfort, pain. When there's identification, there's suffering. When there's identification with thought, how much suffering is there? I had a certain thought, it means I'm a bad person, whatever, or with the emotions, whatever. The identification brings us suffering, as I said, right at the beginning. Certainly, if we talk about thought for a few moments, certain kinds of thought, how much problem do we have with those in our life? How much pain and suffering is bound up in the area of thought? But, you know, one particular genre of thought is the judgmental thought. You know, this particularly self-judgmentalism. How much pain in that? When the practice, again, just to paint a picture, when the practice goes deeper, there's some calmness, one can begin regarding even the thoughts that happen as not self, not me, not mine. It's harder to do when there's not the calmness and there's sort of a thicket of thoughts. But as the calmness comes, there's a certain space opens up in the awareness. And it can almost be like the thoughts are like fireworks appearing in the night sky, and they just come into being in dazzling color, and it's like, whoa, look at that. And then they disappear, and they just disappear into the night sky, and they're not taken as me or mine or saying anything about me or mine. They're just something arising and passing in the space of awareness, ephemeral, 99.9% of the time insignificant, just a thought, not me, not mine, not a problem. When with practice we are able to have this non-identification with thought, then that whole mass of structure, that painful kind of edifice, that, you know, cliff, rock of pain that comes from judgment, particularly self-judgmental thought, measuring ourselves, comparing, how am I doing, am I okay, am I good enough, I'm a this or I'm a that, all that begins to crumble. Seeing it as not self is the most powerful thing for ending this kind of tyranny of self-judgment. And it's interesting how it happens. Sometimes it goes like those huge chunks of the Greenland ice shelf that just been falling recently into the sea. Sometimes it's much more gradual. It just goes. Sometimes, through this non-identification that we're practicing, it's almost as if the habit of the thought is still there. So I remember, for instance, having quite a self-judgmental little monster in my head, and practicing in this way, and after a while, and it was actually years, but after a while, the thoughts would still go. So it would still be like, Rob, you're an idiot, or you know, whatever. But they had no power to them. It was just completely empty, vapid, just a sort of running out of batteries, running out of steam. And then after a while, even that went. Even that went. It's not that one moves from this kind of climate of harshness with oneself, of self-judgmentalism, putting oneself down, that one moves from there into, I am now fantastic, and all of that, and one inflates oneself. It's more that one just loses interest in the whole kind of up-down thing. One loses interest in judging oneself, in evaluating oneself, in believing in that. The energy has just gone out of it. Now, I don't know when I say that. Sometimes I think for people it just seems like, well, maybe for some people, but not for me, you don't know. What goes on in here. I would say that it's possible for everyone. It's really possible for everyone to let go of that whole painful structure of self-judgmental thoughts, self-view, that the constriction of that, the tyranny of it. It's actually possible for everyone in this room to have let go of that, either gradually or suddenly or whatever. So this morning I said something that what we're interested in is an understanding of this self to many different approaches to practice possible. What is it that we need to understand? What is it that we need to understand? In Dharma language, we need to understand that the self is empty. It's empty of inherent existence. It doesn't exist in the way that it appears to, as something real. So, what that partially means is the self is kind of dependent. The sense of self is something that gets built up or relaxed. So it's always, we were talking about this earlier in the question answer period, you can have different degrees of self. Sometimes the self is completely raging. It's taking up everything. It's really full of thought and there's a lot of energy involved in the self. The self is quite big. Sometimes it's just what we would call the normal sense of self. So I'm just sitting around with a friend or whatever, or on my own. Sometimes it's quieter and then it can get quieter and quieter. What we want to understand is that this whole experience of self is something that gets built up, again, by conditions. If it was real, if self was real, it would always be a certain way. It would always appear a certain way, independent of the conditions. So when one asks, what is it, okay, that builds up the sense of self? This is a very deep question now, a very deep sort of Dharma question. One of the things is this measuring and comparing that we do. So the food, you could say, the self feeds on measuring and comparing and evaluating. More measuring and comparing there is, the bigger the sense of self, the more active the sense of self, the busy the sense of self. But conversely, and you often get this mutual kind of dependence with things. What do you think one of the favorite activities of the self is measuring and comparing. So more measuring, comparing, more self, more measuring, comparing. They kind of feed each other to see this in our lives. You can't completely knock measuring and comparing because it's actually fundamentally entwined with our perceptual process. But just to see how much energy we give that will be how much energy there is in the self. Another thing, or a similar thing, a different angle, grasping. So when something, either outer or inner, is a big deal, when we have made it a big deal through our relationship with it, then the self is big. The sense of self is big. When the sense of self is big, it goes out looking for something in the world to be a big deal. So the sense of self depends on something it's making something of. It's making a big deal. You can see this at a very gross level. When we really get something is really a problem, there's a lot of sense of self there. When nothing is really standing out in experience, maybe sometimes in meditation or just walking in nature, nothing's really standing out, sense of self gets quieter. Self and the world, so-called, self and things, are dependent on each other. They feed each other. They're mutually dependent. This is very, I'm talking at a very deep level now, so just to why not go there? When we begin to see this, self and the world are kind of dependent on each other. They arise together. Self and the world arise together. When we really begin to see that, there comes a love, because there comes a sense of a knowing of non-separation. This self, the sense I have, is of something separate from the world. Here's me, there's the world. It's separate. I end here. We begin to get a sense of self and the world being somehow mutually dependent, mutually penetrating in a way. Very, very profound, very beautiful, and what opens in the heart then. So with this investigation into non-self comes actually very deep love, and we begin to authentically have a relationship with life where we're really treating the happiness of others equal to our own, and it's not kind of force. It's simply coming into being out of that understanding. Going into the sense of self, the emptiness of self, it also frees our love, whatever love we have, it frees it from inhibition. So how often in life, again the pain of this, how often have we felt love and felt an urge to express love to someone or to those close or whatever, and we've just been a bit shy or a bit inhibited or a bit scared with it. And it's because of the self, because of the self-sense. So it frees our love to flow and to grow. It also frees our self-expression. So paradoxically, when we see the emptiness of self, when we let go of our constriction around self, or the constriction of self, we're actually free to express more of who we are, more of the fullness and the range of who we are. Because there's no problem in defining ourselves or being constricted by a definition or worrying about what others think. And the self-expression at every level, you know, creatively and relationship and in whatever, is freed in the life. So I'm aware of time, so I'll just say a couple more things. With practice, when we begin to be able to let go of the agenda of self more and more, or from time to time, the agenda of self is basically what's in it for me. So we open a door to go into a room, and without even being aware of it, we're going into that room, what's in it for me? Something threatening? Something bad? Something I want? Something I don't want? Or in a meditation experience or whatever, we're mostly going through the life with the agenda of self. What's in this next moment for me? It's very deep. As we begin to let go of that, and sometimes just for little snatches of time, something else begins to kind of be seen. The more we let go of this agenda of self, it's like the more the radiance and the mystery of life, of all things, can begin to shine through. Because we're not pushing one thing away and pulling something else towards us. We're not elevating something and deflating something else. Something in more fundamental to being, to things, begins to shine through. It's like the peace of all things begins to shine through. This is hard sometimes when we hear about this, because we have a sense in our life mostly that the excitement or our sense of life itself is actually associated a lot with self, with what I'm going to get or what might come my way that I don't want, or that whole excitement, fear, and what am I going to get is associated with self and the self choosing. And so it can be almost like we can't really imagine that there could be a juiciness, a beauty to the peace that's there when we're not doing that. So in practice, if one goes into this in practice, and it is really a big project, as I said, one notices something. The self sense comes and it goes, and it comes and it goes, and it comes somewhat strongly or very little, and it goes. As I said, dependent on conditions. Sometimes it's very light, sometimes it's very heavy, sometimes it's normal, sometimes it's not there at all, but it comes and goes. And begin to get a sense that the sense of self is not a problem. It's coming and going, and it's not a problem. It's just the appearance of things. It's just the appearance of self. Don't quite take it as seriously as we habitually do. Can take the whole sense of self very lightly. The more that we take the sense of self lightly in our lives, the more we do that, the more and more it's like some other truth can begin to shine through in life. And that truth is something that brings like profound freedom. Profound opening of the heart. So I was going to end there, but I will just tack one tiny which is this, and we touched on it in the question and answer period before, but only a few people were here. Self is empty, means it's not real in the way we think it is, which means that we are free to take up a view of self and to let go of it. So what that means is sometimes people ask, well, what about, you know, I'm in psychotherapy and I'm working on myself and I'm looking at myself and my history and my story, etc. That's fine. It's very valid. There's a lot of healing and freedom that comes out of looking at one's life and experience in terms of self. And in a way, that's what psychotherapy does a lot. It's looking at that level and hopefully bring a healing, bring a certain level of freedom. What I've just described as well is letting go of that sense of self, which I would say brings a whole other level of healing and freedom. It's not that one is good and one is bad. It's rather that as human beings we are free to move between the two, free to take up one and put it down. Mostly human beings are not capable of putting down the self. Not an option. But to see, where does the fear come in? Am I afraid of self? Afraid of going into the self and using the language of the self? Afraid of identifying? Or am I afraid of not identifying? And practicing so that there's this fearlessness and freedom to move between the two. So I put that out there. It may be something that gets part of the question answer period, but okay, enough talking. Let's just sit quietly for a minute before the next walking period. have a period for some walking meditation now. Who's the bell ringer? If we could aim to have the next sitting at 25 past, so I don't know what time that would make the bell at, but okay, thanks. Thanks, Claire. So next sitting at 25 past, and there will be a time for some discussion of this or question and answers after that. Okay, so now it's a period for some walking meditation.